Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hello and welcome to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Oswald, and I hope you join me on my quest for knowledge to become a better public land hunter, angler, and forager. Stick with this and who knows, maybe we will learn something together. All right, real quick before we get started on the show, I'm just going to talk about Tree Line Academy. You've heard me say it. I can't even tell you how many times. Mark Livesay is treelineacademy.net. That's treelineacademy.net. Sign up. Use the promo code PC2020. Save yourself $20. Can't say it enough. It's awesome. Amazing. Most comprehensive e-scouting course out there. Check it out for yourself. Sign up. Use promo code PC2020. And now let's get to the show.
All right. So I'm sitting here and I am talking to Mark Hertzfeldt. And I got that right, right?
Yep, you got it. Right on.
So, Mark, I kind of saw some of the cool stuff you were doing and wanted to get you on and talk about that because I thought it was pretty cool. And it turns out, like, I guess somehow you've been following me for a little while and, like, something of yours popped up and I'm like, hey, what's this? And started digging through and I'm like, oh, we follow each other. I didn't even know. It happens a lot. I've started to notice after a certain amount of people, you get to a certain point where you don't see everything and you start missing things and you wish you could go back, but sometimes it doesn't really happen. But can you go ahead and introduce?
Well, and that's the thing. Yeah. With I'll introduce myself. Oh yeah. That's with social media and everything, you know, and you follow people for certain reasons and then, you know, your feed kind of probably gets a little bit manipulated and you start liking certain things and then you only see those, but then eventually those other, you know, you get to scrolling through and then those other accounts show up for you too. So, I'm Mark Hertzfeldt. I am born and raised in the Midwest in Wisconsin, and about 5 years ago, well, I was basically brought up hunting and fishing with my dad and family and brother, and I was brought up hunting and fishing, just grew to love hunting probably a little bit more than fishing, and it's just been a passion of mine as far as bow hunting more specifically. I haven't really picked up a gun to do any hunting in a long, long time. And then about, I would say, 4 or 5 years ago, my family and I decided to move out to North Carolina. Climate's a little bit warmer than the Midwest. And North Carolina has kind of the best of both worlds as far as out west, you have the mountains, and if you go the other way towards the coast, you got the beaches and warm climates, and So yeah, that's pretty much my background as far as that goes. And then just learning to hunt all over again, moving from the Midwest over here to North Carolina. That wouldn't think it, but the deer and everything are just way different. So been trying to figure out how to hunt deer out here in North Carolina for the last 4 years. So
when you hunted in Wisconsin, it was kind of more like agricultural, right? You were kind of, yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was mainly, we had, a family farm, not my immediate family, but my dad's cousins. And we were allowed to hunt out on their farm. And that's how I grew up, was hunting farmland. So we got to know the property really well. And from age 12 until, let's see, just a few years ago, 5 years ago, we would hunt the family farm. And then, you know, through college and things, I was down in the Milwaukee area and hunted a lot of some of the public lands down that way. And, I was gaining access to just by knocking on doors and things like that. And, so it was a lot of agriculture, and public land there at the end there. So,
I'm kind of curious, cause I remember like the property that I had that was a decent sized private chunk, and it was way better property than I ever knew of or how to even hunt at the time. But we had nicknames for all of our stands. So like there was a funnel that would go through like a good cover of pine trees, and on the other side was a hedgerow, and it would funnel the deer through that. They'd take that to get out into some of the fields and stuff. So we called that the pipeline. And then there were some other ones, you know, like the big elm was one of them. That was a big old elm that we had a tree stand in. And I'm kind of curious, did you guys have a bunch of nicknames for all your tree stands? Or
I would say it was more of this, like, based on locations within the farm. Like, you know, and it was my dad, my brother, and I. So we all kind of had our own little areas, you know, and we all just kind of like had those areas. But, you know, we'd always, you know, the old four-wheeler trail. So that's kind of where I hunted quite a bit. And so we did have, you know, some of that where. And it's funny, it says before you were even, you know, thought you knew how to hunt or and that sort of thing. Like we just went out and we sat every weekend afternoon, and we just hoped the deer come by. And so, you know, we wouldn't really pay attention to the wind. We'd just go out and hunt. And that was, that was fun.
I used to do it too. Same thing. Just, oh, well, and then once you did kind of learn, like, yeah, I should probably play the wind a little bit, but you're working with a limited piece of property too. And it's like, you know, oh, maybe I'll go to the elm instead of the pipeline or whatever, you know, and you're maybe moving 100 or, you know, 200 yards opposite spot.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause you knew where the deer were and you knew their patterns. And so, you know, when hunting that property, it was, you knew eventually, like every year I knew I would get a shot at a deer. It was just a matter of time, just put the time in and, you know, you'd get a shot at a pretty decent buck or at least see one. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's where I, you know, that's how I think a lot of us started out.
Yeah. Biggest buck of my life was one of the first sits that I ever sat. And my buddy's dad came out to the property, right when my parents bought a chunk of it, and the rest of it I just had access to. And he came out and started looking around and put up some tree stands, and he was a pretty avid and good bow hunter back in the day. And he set up a couple stands, and I went and sat in one. It was like my first or second sit out, and I'm sitting there and I'm waiting. Finally the sun comes up, and it's, I mean, like barely legal shooting light. Biggest buck I've ever seen in my life at that point in time, and still one of the biggest bucks I've ever seen that I took a shot at. And he comes along perfectly broadside. I draw back, no rangefinders back then, you know. I think I was like 15 years old. So we're talking like 2000-ish. So and completely miss, just right over him. It sails right over him, and he kind of stops, and he looks around. And I put another arrow in, and I draw back right under him. And I'm like, nice. Oh, man. Then he takes off, and that was like the last time I ever saw him. I think somebody got him during that shotgun season or something. But it was just like the experiences like that that you had no idea, or if you would have practiced or measured out trees or just known any of those things, it could have been a lot different. My story would have been a lot different.
right. Exactly. I've got similar stories, and it was a good place to hunt because you always knew it. And then, you know, on the beginning, when I first was starting out, baiting was legal. So, and that's kind of what I'm going back on, because my daughter is now 11 going on 12, and in North Carolina here, you can, youth can start hunting, I think, pretty much any age, as long as you're with a licensed hunter or an adult. But basically, you know, we're trying to get the bait so that the deer stop and they're nice and still. And so that's how I started out with big old bait piles, and we made sure those were good and ready for opening season and throughout the season. And then baiting kind of got taken away, and that's when you really started trying to learn how to hunt. Yeah. So it was, and then it was more like, well, we'll just waiting for the rutten to come around, and you know, wait for that cruising deer to come by. So
I still take the rutcation every year. That's still my kind of thing, you know. Yeah. But I got to ask you, did you watch on Sundays? Did you go out hunting, or were you too busy watching the Packers play?
Well, it was always a tough call, but yeah, we were out every Saturday and Sunday as much as we could. We, without trying to burn up our spots too bad, you know, because we did realize that if you did go out every time into the same spot, you know, you're going to burn that spot out. So yeah, it wasn't every other weekend, I would say, in the beginning, but once the rutcation came around, then trying to figure out how to get out of school and go hunting.
I never had to worry about that too much, but you know, sick days and stuff kind of covered that. But now, unfortunately, with social media, you can't use the sick days at work and you end up getting the booner or something, a buck of a lifetime, and then the next thing you know, you want to post it, and that wouldn't be good. So now you actually have to take vacation during that time. But so I mean, how old is your daughter? I don't know if you said how old she is.
She's 11. So she's always come out with me. I always took her along when she was really young. I mean, 3-4 years old, I was out scouting with her, and she's always just loved to come out and sit in the woods. And so this year we tried turkey hunting with a bow, and I've hunted public land for 4 years out here, and just this year finally found a lease. So we pretty much stayed on the lease because I didn't want to drag her through so much public land doing the walking and climbing of the hills out here, that I really want her to stay interested rather than drag her 3-4 miles and not see anything. Well, we ended up not really seeing anything at all turkey hunting. And then this year, she's out hunting with me, archery hunting with me, and we're seeing deer, and that's just been fun to watch because she gets real excited when deer come in. So that's what's keeping us going here as well. So I'm not even bringing my bow until she pretty much gets a shot, or we get, you know, close enough where we can get a few shots off. Maybe I'll take some vacation during the week and go out if she's got school, but that's what I'm focusing on this year. Yeah, so
that's good. Like you and I talked a little, you know, a few days earlier. I don't know how I could do it. I mean, my kids are still a little bit too young, I think, to do that, but how did you even keep them keep her still, like when you take her out hunting with you, or I mean, just a lot of snacks or what? I mean, that's kind of what I found that works is snacks. Yep. When the snacks run out, it's like game over. You better be ready to pack your stuff up and go home.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, we don't, that's the other thing. Like ground blinds are really good. Because my son too, he's 8 years old, and like I'll bring them both out and turkey hunting. And as long as they're occupied, they bring books, bring screens or whatever, and keep them occupied for a while. But if we're only out there for an hour, that's fine. Because, you know, like we didn't really see much as far as turkeys this spring, but we did have a time when there were some gobblers responding to our calls, and like just to see their faces when those gobblers would respond, you know, that was worth it right there. And I think we were only out for maybe an hour, but yeah, that's as far as movement goes, and ground blinds work pretty well. We are hunting from tree stands this fall, and that is the thing, because like I'm trying to think, like when you were 11 and like can't sit still.
No. I have a hard time sitting still now, you know.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And now with saddle hunting now, like you're just swinging up there. I have to stop myself. But yeah, like I really don't care. Like I'm on the watch for as much as I can for deer, and you know, if we start up a conversation, we start up a conversation. And you know, if we've got bugs and we're swatting bugs, then we try to get those away. But yeah, it's a big learning. And then we're hunting in the same tree, so just really trying to, you know, be right next to her and let her and coach her through the whole process as much as I can. So
I think that's probably like the most fun part, probably, or the most rewarding is being right there and watching those emotions and kind of like guiding her through that. I think that's the thing I look forward to the most. Maybe not even the animal, but just getting them to that point, you know. And I mean, I'm sure that it's a whole nother gamut of emotions that happen once that happens with the animal too. So best of luck with that, man, for sure. And I hope she's successful. That'll be pretty cool.
I'm hoping. I know then. I mean, she's pretty hooked right now, but I'm pretty sure that'll seal the deal as far as a hunting partner for life. So that's my goal here.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So you mentioned saddle hunting, and I'm kind of curious because, like we were mentioning a little bit earlier before the podcast, that you've got it and it's a passion of yours that's become a pretty nice little business that you got going there. So let's kind of transition into that and talk about some of the products that you have and kind of, you know, why or how you came about doing them.
Sure. Yeah. So when I first moved out to North Carolina, I mean, I was hunting mainly public land, and, you know, I'd always, to be mobile, hunted from a tree stand or like a climber tree stand or lock on sometimes, but climber was my main go-to. And then coming out here, the terrain is so much different. So there are some pretty decent hills that you have to climb. And, you know, I've hunted public land in the Midwest, but not as serious as out here. So realize that, you know, in order to find deer out here, you really do need to do a lot of walking. And a lot of my decent areas tended to be a mile or two into these public lands. And after hauling a climber and a backpack, and I do sell film, you know, that gets to be pretty heavy. And at the point that I really decided that I needed a lighter setup, which was the saddle, was, you know, I went in a couple miles and set up and up in the tree and forgot my release to my bow. And it was like, now what do you do? Right? Like, do you sit out and film, which I was probably okay with, or try to, you know, I wasn't comfortable just shooting with three fingers anymore, the compound bow. So, I decided to pack it up, and it was early enough in the morning that I was going to go back and get my release. And but it was just at that point I was like, I need something to be as mobile as possible. So that's when I decided saddle hunting was the way to go. And then I'm an engineer, so like from I've watched 3D printing for quite a few years actually, and I like a few years ago was when I got into 3D printing, and really just because I was really interested in it and I wanted to see what I could do. I always loved bringing ideas to life, basically, because you can have all these ideas, and as an engineer, you can design them up and they look great on the computer. But then once you actually can produce it pretty much in your garage or, you know, wherever you have the space to have a printer, you know, those ideas pretty much can be put into use because of the materials that have come so far as printing materials. So you can basically bring an idea to life. And so then once you bring in saddle hunting and 3D printing and an engineering mind that just has a lot of ideas, I would say, and I think they're all great, but you can bring some of those ideas. So out of necessity, I was just starting to print things to make my saddle setup a little bit easier. So that's kind of where it started. And then I started, you know, sharing things on social media, and people were pretty interested, and it kind of just grew from there, really. I mean, you know, people were asking, hey, you know, can you make me a few of those? And yeah, it just kind of went from there, and I've just brought the ideas that I've had to life. I work with a lot of other hunters that say, hey, you know, I've got this idea. Can we do something? And so I'll work with them to bring their idea to life and send it to them and try it out. And that's the way to go. So one of the biggest things I mentioned with the tree climber and the self filming was the camera setup. So I started out hunting from a tree stand, and camera arms were, you know, in my pack, and I had, you know, like a fairly decent camera arm, but the thing weighed over 10 pounds without the fluid head and camera. So I thought there's gotta be a better way to pack in something way lighter to hold a camera. And it started out, I wanted to completely 3D print it and realized that, you know, materials are great as far as filaments that can be printed. Probably got to go up a little bit more in cost than in the printers that I have that maybe is possible, but found out I couldn't 100% 3D print, and then started looking more towards aluminum, and then adding 3D printed parts onto aluminum, and basically working with a local fabricator, came up with a pretty lightweight, less than 2 pound camera arm. So that's kind of just how the ideas keep growing, and what I do as far as the DIY bow hunting part of it.
I'm kind of curious, what was the first thing that you created, and like what was the necessity or the why behind it? I'm sure it probably wasn't the camera arm, or was it?
No, it wasn't. The first things were just the simple clips and things you need to climb. So in a saddle, like you're completely mobile, and so I was hunting with sticks to climb the tree and a platform. And the more and more research I did around, you know, saddle hunting and climbing trees, was you can get those first two sticks up on a tree, but those other two sticks, it's nice to climb with them hanging on rather than going down to the bottom of the tree every time. And you'll find them all over the place, but just a simple clip with a continuous loop. I use an Amsteel continuous loop inside of a clip, and basically you can hang your sticks on both sides of you and a platform off the back. So you can basically pull those things off your saddle as you're climbing up in the tree, and then So those simple saddle clips were it. And then once you get up in the tree, the next thing is you got to hang all your gear. So then, you know, creating some simple hooks and a bow hanger for up in the tree. And that's where it kind of started. And then from there, you know, just refining my setup. I mean, everybody's got, when you buy a set of sticks, you've got a set of cam buckles on your sticks or cam straps, and I always figured out how to make that cam buckle hit the aluminum stick as you're putting it up. So I printed out of a rubber like material some silencers, basically, so like slip a cover that slips over that cam buckle. So those were the first things that were kind of out of a necessity type thing as far as saddle hunting goes that I created.
No, I think that's really cool because I've seen a lot of different ways people have tried to silence buckles, whether it be putting stealth strips or some type of other felt type material on them, or they put heat shrink tubing on them and then you got to cut the heat shrink tubing. But if you accidentally slide that out of there, you know, your webbing out of there and it's fully out, it's almost impossible to get it back in with that heat shrink tubing on. And so I'd been looking for ways and trying to figure it out. And then I don't know where I saw it. And that wasn't even the first thing of yours I saw, but I was like, what? This is all the same guy making this stuff. And, right. And somebody's like, oh yeah, this is 3D printed and it's a rubberized material. And I'm like, that's freaking awesome. Like, that is cool. Right. And to see, like, not only I was the only one who was thinking about it, but didn't have the background or whatever to make it happen or make it possible, but you did. And now there's, like, a demand for it, right? There's people that want that. I mean, that's got to be a pretty good feeling to kind of, you know that you came up with it and then have people actually want it and, you know, asking you and doing all those things. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, I love that when at least – when I can hear that, you know, somebody is actually using them and then they go out and they create a video, you know, on around that product, doing a review around that product. And, you know, it's just, yeah, it does. It makes me feel good. I mean, and it also, I like it that it's actually helping them in their hunting experience. So it's actually working for them, you know, the way it was designed and it's not just, you know, a crazy idea that I had, and it works for myself and my setup. And that's the other thing is, like, every hunter has their own system, and that's where 3D printing really helps out. Is, you know, they can come to me and ask, you know, hey, can I get this here, or can I modify this design just a little bit because my system, this is how I do it, and this is how I'm comfortable with it. So, you know, rather than, you know, just buying a standard, just say bow hanger, you know, you can kind of customize the design on the fly for that specific individual.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty cool because let's face it, most of the commercially available bow hangers suck. They just suck. They're not good. I'll just say it, Muddy. They make some crap. It's garbage. Most of the stuff that they make for, like, hanging your stuff is junk. Yeah. And, like, I bought a Muddy, I don't remember the name of it, but it was like where it's got the buckles on it and a slider to, like, tension it up, and it had like four or five plastic hooks on it. And you could not hang anything. Like, if you put your bow on that, the hanger is like halfway sideways already, and it looks like it's about to break. The plastic on it turned white, like it was embrittled. And it was just terrible. And I mean, I think I paid like $18 or something stupid for that. And it's like, this is junk. And I thought to myself after I bought it, I'm like, man, I've got better webbing in my basement from previous projects that I've done that I have with all kinds of buckles and stuff. And I'm like, I can make a better one, but I can't make a better hook. And then here comes all these engineers and 3D printing, and what I find funny about it though is that, like, you don't get too many tree stand hunters that put hang-ons or lock-ons or ladder stands or whatever. They don't modify gear at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just don't. I mean, what are you going to do other than maybe like something to your sticks? You might change out buckles to whatever, you know, a rope method or whatever. But they're not going to modify the tree stand that the manufacturer made. But then here comes saddle hunters.
And yeah.
They, even if something works absolutely perfect, somebody's going to tear it apart and put something else on it just to see if it works or works for them. And it's crazy.
Yep.
I'm starting to notice, like, the more I start following, because I kind of just, you know, bought a saddle, got in it, blah, blah, blah. And there was a lot of things that I thought to myself, like I made my own anchor and my own lineman's belt and all that kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. I'd never really went to the extreme with modifications. But now I'm seeing all these things come out and all these people, and some of them are tried and true now, so I'm willing to use them. But
that is a great point, because you know, like, I don't know what it is, but like, I'm a DIYer, you know, through and through, but, and that's maybe why I am now liking saddle hunting and the saddle hunting crowd so much, because they're willing to do the DIY things and try new things. And I think there's definitely a limit to that as far as, you know, safety is involved. And that's one thing that I try to stress. I mean, you know, when doing anything yourself, you're taking your life into your own hands, as far as you're basically hanging from the side of a tree. So, you know, there's only so far you want to go with DIY and be careful.
I've seen things, and I talked about this on one of my previous podcasts that I just did, but mm-hmm. there is cringeworthy things out there that you see people doing and you're like, ooh, no, just don't do that. Don't do that. And then mm-hmm. here I go and break one of my golden rules. And just the other day I went and put some stealth tape on my carabiners, which you don't do, because if there's a flaw or a crack or something, you're obviously not going to see it. But at the same time, I don't know, I kind of want to be quieter on that.
And I've done it too. I mean, I used the camo wrap and I've done it too to the carabiners, and now I gotta use the black ones, I guess. I'm not sure, but yeah, it's that's the one thing that, you know, when it comes to 3D printing, I see a lot of things as far as 3D printing goes that there's no way that I'm gonna try and do that. So people always ask about 3D printed steps and even 3D printed platforms, and so I just stay away from that stuff completely, because I don't want to be responsible for anybody getting hurt. So there is a huge DIY crowd in the saddle hunting industry, and I think it's more just because it is so new to everybody that some of the gears just that is needed just isn't there yet, and the bigger companies are starting to come out with it and making it more mainstream. There's always a place for the hunter and being customizing your own gear. Cause I think every hunter has their own type of system and it works in their way. So,
yeah, no, it's pretty cool though. I mean, cause I've always been like a DIY guy. My wife always gets on me all the time that I've got too many hobbies and crafts and whatever that I do, but it's like, it all somehow ties into each other. Like, I started making knives, and then I had a need to learn how to do leather work so I could make holsters. And then once I started doing the leather work, I was like, hey, now I can make a holster for my gun rather than just a sheath for the knife. So then it kind of snowballed into that. And then, you know, the next thing and so on. So when that came to traditional hunting for a while there, I shot a trad bow, and it was like, well, now I can make all my stuff. So I made my own wraps for my handle of the bow, and I made my own string silencers out of fur that I had. And I mean, I just, you know, went and did it all. And then I couldn't afford a Safari Tough quiver, so it was like that nice soft fleece lined one. So I went and made my own. I went and got some drain pipe, you know, the real lightweight PVC. and I silenced inside with felt and silenced outside. Did all that kind of stuff, and it was like, I get it, but still, like, I don't know, man. Maybe I'm just not confident enough in, like, because I was never a rock climber or any of that kind of stuff that, you know, I don't know. Maybe I've fallen one too many times.
Well, and to your point too, like I, from a, when I got into saddle hunting, I'm also pretty cheap. So, you know, making my own stuff is, you know, the way to go as far as when I'm making my own gear, or if I look at something and say, yeah, I can make it. That's kind of the fun for me is like, that is what I enjoy doing. So I'd rather take on the project rather than just go buy it in the store, just because it's a project. So I'll spend probably twice as much as I would have paid for it at a Cabela's or someplace, but I had fun learning how it works and how to make it myself.
So. I get quite a few eye rolls and comments from my wife because she's like, the money you spent on the tooling or whatever it was in order to get to that point to where I could make whatever I did or the time it took me to learn it or whatever, and then I do it and I make it. And she's like, you could have went out and bought like two of those for what you just did. And then I'm like, yeah, but now I know how to do it and I have the material. So now it's not going to cost me anything and I'll always know how to do it. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. I can always make another one.
Yeah.
but that to me, like, I guess, I don't know if it's justification in my own head, but that's just what I look at as far as hunting in general. Like there's a project around, hunting or gear or whatever, I'll spend the money to make it myself and have fun doing that and learn along the way. Rather than going out and just buying it sometimes.
The one thing that I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it.
Okay. Cause the one thing that I did build that, was like a complete DIY was the Ernie platform. So I built the Ernie platform from the forums type stuff. And I was actually going to, I do a little bit of machining and I was going to machine my own standoffs and everything for the tree. And a buddy of mine, that had a podcast, him and I were kind of messaging back and forth and I'm like, no, you're going to see, once you see mine, you're going to like crap yourself. It's going to be so awesome, you know, and like going back and forth and just kind of like razzing each other a little bit. And he's like, you know, you can just buy those, right? And I'm like, no, I was going to make them. Why would I need to buy them? And then when I saw the price and figured out how long it would actually take me to do it and cost of buying the aluminum to do it and knowing that I might screw up one before I get the two good ones that I needed.
Yep.
I was like, okay, I'll break down. And that was like the first stuff I ever bought from Dano over at Eastern Woods Outdoors or Double Steps.
Yep.
So I bought that stuff and then cut down my own aluminum tubing. I had that kind of stuff. And then it just kind of snowballed into the whole project. And I ended up making two of them. Never put them on the tree, though, because I probably wouldn't have made the second one. It wasn't stable enough. Like, no matter what you did, it could still kick out on you if you put any side pressure on it. So it wasn't what I was looking for. And then next thing you know, there I am looking, waiting untethered until the Predator comes back in stock. And then once it finally did come back in stock, I clicked and broke down and bought it.
Yep. I mean, that's kind of the story with the camera arm as well. I mean, I put a lot. I gave up on the whole camera arm thing because I even sent out some samples to some guys to try, and I thought I really had it as far as, you know, a super lightweight printed camera arm, but it never had the strength that I was hoping for. So I kind of just stopped with it because I was like, you know, I'm trying to reinvent the wheel here because the big guys, they've got it figured out. And I've now realized why camera arms cost as much as they do. And, you know, you buy the features that they have. And so I just kind of stopped at it, but for some reason I was walking through Home Depot the one time and just had an aha moment and said, I think I can make it work with this, and kind of threw together a prototype and started playing with it, and that's how that developed as well. So yeah, I've got a lot of I'll call them failures, but many learnings as well from a lot of prototypes. So
the Home Depot aluminum rack is quite expensive. You could go to an actual scrapyard and get the stuff that was leftovers from a job or something and get it and buy it for scrap weight for the aluminum. It's way cheaper.
Definitely. That's a good idea, actually. I should go and do that.
We can buy new stock as well, but they also have a scrapyard. So I always ask them, I'm like, hey, did you guys get any like job site stuff in or anything like that? I always ask them first, because I'm sitting there and I'll always be playing and fiddling and fingering them and trying to take the two pieces and make them slide in each other just to see what they've got there, you know, and the different products. And I mean, me and my buddies have made a lot of cool things with stuff that we went and got there, but I always ask first, because sometimes they'll even have like where they cut out something where it was like aluminum staircases, and this company bought 100 of them because they needed them for an event. Then they take them for scrap. Well, they cut them up or something stupid instead of bringing them whole, because then they could just sell them whatever. But so they cut them up, and now they've got all these square tubes that are 1-inch square tubes that are like 1/8-inch thick aluminum, and I'm like, hey, I'll take those, you know.
Yep.
Many a times of like way back when I used to hunt some public land that had some trails and stuff, my buddy and I were like, we need bikes for this. So we're like, yeah, but how are we going to carry all our stuff? You know, we didn't have like a backpack you could put all that stuff on. So the bike was the mobile unit. And so we built these big old stands, because back then, what were you carrying? Either a Summit or something larger. I remember for a while there, I was hauling around like a Menards, like whatever brand Menards has, aluminum ladder stand. And I'd take it and put the pins in and stand it up and put it on the tree. But I'd have that on a rack that we made out of aluminum. And luckily, my buddy could weld that stuff up, and we welded it up and bolted it to the bike. And then on the front, we did bow racks. And then I think we even had like a tomahawk holder out of PVC on one of the front forks just for fun. But
holy cow.
Stuff like that, you know. And then you could
I'd love to see a picture of that.
You know, about a year ago, I had a little bit of a flood in the barn, and I was just cleaning out stuff, and I parked it by the curb, but it sat in the barn for years after not using it. But nice. So we had we had nicknames for them. Like, I think mine was the Rut Reaper, and his was something else. We spray painted it on them. It was pretty cool, but just doing stuff like that, you know. I've never gone quite as far as like the stuff you're doing and the detail of it, but yeah, scrapyard is definitely the way to go for materials for your, at least for your prototypes, you know. But
yeah, exactly.
I got to ask you, so when you did it, was your original intention, because I was looking, you've got it to where it's like camera arm kits, you've got it to where it's like, you know, build your own, and then you've got it to where you can actually buy it yourself. Mm-hmm. Was it your original intention to sell the entire camera arm, or was it more of a DIY?
It was when I first came out with it. I mean, yeah, I didn't, my intention wasn't actually to get with a fabricator and, you know, basically build it from everything, or sell the whole thing as one unit. Cause I just really wanted to do the printed work. But that all just came about because I was posting things and people said, hey, I want to make my own. So can I get the printed parts? And then I can do the metalwork myself. So that was kind of the first intention, was just to provide printed parts. But I actually happened to meet up with a fellow saddle hunter, Altered Fabrication, which is here in the Raleigh area of North Carolina. We were chatting on saddlehunter.com and found out he happened to be, you know, just down the street from me. So then we were talking saddle hunting, and then all of a sudden he said, yeah, I'm starting up a fabrication shop too. And I was like, oh, well, that could come in handy. If you can do the fabrication, we could actually combine on some projects. So we've got a lot of things in the works as far as, you know, combining both of our skills actually too. So a lot of things in the works as far as testing, you know, this season and maybe we'll see how they go and coming out further. But yeah, the original intent, I mean, was just really once the 3D printing kind of took off, was just to provide the 3D printing rather than, you know, going into that. I mean, once you've got all the pieces together now, and, you know, they've been fairly consistent and fairly popular now that the season's starting, you know, I never thought I'd be just assembling camber arms. So, so, you know, you're always looking at, you know, is this something that I was intending to do or not? But yeah, it's been fun so far because, like we had mentioned earlier, it's really cool now. I've sold a few camera arms to a lot of YouTubers out there. A lot of people have YouTube channels, hunting channels, and to see the camera arm in the back room while they're filming and being able to share their experience with a bunch of people, knowing that that camera arm was there to help them do that, it's pretty cool to see. So you know, just helping them share their experiences with their family, with their following and everything. So makes getting up at 4 a.m. to assemble camera arms before I go to work a little bit more worth it. So
no, that's cool. So I got to ask you then, because I was on your website. And I was looking, but like we talked about, I'm a DIY guy too. And I saw all the DIY kits are out. Is there an intention to like make parts up for that? Or is it kind of just because there's such a high demand for the entire camera arm that eventually it'll catch up, or the DIY kits no longer available?
The kits are available, and it's basically you can request it. It's probably just my lack of programming the website that they're available. You just need to get a hold of me and let me know what you need, because I'll print them up for you, no problem. I've got a lot of parts on hand, and if you want, I've had a lot of guys just request some more custom parts because they say, hey, I'm gonna do this with my arm. And then I'll just print them up, whatever they need, and send them the printed parts. And then they go ahead and they make their own camera arm. That's available.
Okay. So. Well, that's cool then. So now I'm not as worried, because even though I bought one, I ended up breaking down and buying a camera arm. Not your camera arm, but a different camera arm. But I still want to build one. So,
right.
Because you can't have just one camera arm. What do you do if you got two people out, right? You both ought to have a camera arm on the tree. So,
well, especially because you have access to all that scrap aluminum, man, that's like gold right there.
Actually, I got a buddy that tore apart a bunch of climbing sticks and cannibalized and made some of his own hybrid things and stuff like that. And him and I were talking about camera arms the other day, and he goes, hey, I got a bunch of old sticks. It's just the tubes for the sticks, but if you want them, he's like, probably be like 15, 20 bucks. I'll mail them all these. Like, I probably got like 8 or 10 of them. I'm like, yeah, I'll take them. I'll take them for sure. So
definitely.
I probably got those in the mail coming. So that's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll print you up some parts for them. If you tell me the size of the tube, that's nothing. That's good.
Yeah. So no, that was not the original intention of me coming on here, but I had to razz you and ask you about that because I was looking, it was after we talked and I was looking, cause I saw your camera stuff already. And then you and I talked on the phone, and afterwards I was like, yeah, maybe I'll order some stuff and I'll try and build it before we do the interview. I looked at the website. So.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. Like, it's all very common parts. They're common fasteners. They're simple things. So even if you get it and you want to modify it, like take it apart and reconfigure it, yeah, that's what it's there for. But it's also there for the more mobile, lightweight person as well. So
Yeah. No, I mean, like, I thought about just going and getting a bunch of Teflon washers and stuff like that and bolting my own stuff together. But I was looking at it and looked like you had some pretty cool pieces, especially for, you know, actually attaching, like, your head to your pan head or swivel head or whatever you're using, attaching that kind of stuff. It looked like that was kind of where your detailed stuff came into, definitely into play there, and your brackets, yep, stuff like that.
Yeah, the standoff, and that's where, like, you know, you can make your own standoff out of aluminum or print it. You're going to save some weight there. The biggest thing I think, you know, for this is definitely getting it tight to the tree, because you can, if you don't have anything that's tight to the tree, you got to have a pretty good quality strap. That's also part of it. So, just to keep in mind when you're building your own camera arm.
So let's kind of talk about that real quick then too, because I noticed the type of strap you use is a cam buckle, right? Like it's an over the center
OCB buckle or bolt buckle. And that was mainly because, you know, if you buy, I don't know if you buy a camera arm today, I think they all come with a ratchet strap. And so ratchet straps are noisy, but they will get you. And the reason is because they get that base really tight to the tree, just like a tree stand. You know, you get that ratchet strap with it, but the OCB will get it just as tight as a ratchet strap, and you don't have that ratcheting or that noise. So it's a simple run it through twice and pull it, cam it over. And it'll get, you'll actually have to get a good feel for it, because you can get it too tight. And I mean, you won't be able to physically pull the buckle over. So it gets pretty tight. So it's a nice quiet strap.
Yeah, I like that, because I was looking at the one I bought, and it's definitely got ratchet straps to it. And the base is super clunky. Like, it is stupid clunky. And I don't know, people could probably figure out what I bought without even knowing, but it's not a Muddy, but.
Well, and that's the thing. So I, you know, there's a lot of good arms out on the market, and I have nothing bad to say about, you know, most of them just, but they're just heavy. So, but you're paying for that maximum adjustability in many of them. So you can put your arm on and you can adjust it at any angle that you want, and that's the technology and the engineering that's gone into it, and it's worth the money you spend on it.
Yeah, I don't know about the one I got, but
sounds good.
It's just too clunky.
I've seen a lot of them just because I'm making them, but there are definitely lower quality arms out there.
So I got to ask you, is there anything that you can talk about that's coming up on the horizon that's pretty cool and you're excited about, or maybe not yet?
I'm pretty open with my designs as far as sharing ideas and things like that. You know, I've always looked at, there's not many strapped bow hangers out there. A lot of them screw into the tree for tree stand hunters. So for saddle hunters, you know, your bow is pretty much right alongside the tree. There's no reason really to bring it out farther from the tree. But when you're in a tree stand, you like that bow out kind of out in front of you and just ready. And so a lot of those types of bow hangers are screw into the tree, and there are a couple out there that you strap onto the tree, but I've got some ideas around that, where you can have a nice public land legal strap bow hanger that'll hold your bow out a little bit further. So some ideas that are being tested. I don't know, you know, how well they're going to be working throughout the whole season, but you know, those are some of the things that are working on, just because I've got the fabricator so close. So
nice. No, it's pretty cool. So I think that's probably a good point here to ask you this then. If somebody wants to buy your products or get in touch with you and maybe ask you a few questions about something, or maybe even have you do some custom work or something like that, where would they get a hold of you?
The best way would be the two places would be my website, DIYbowhunting.com. There's a contact page on there. And I'm most active through Instagram. So you can contact me through there as well. So just message me and we can work on your project.
Very nice. That's pretty cool, Mark. I appreciate you coming on and talking to me and sharing about your cool stuff that you got going on. And thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, I appreciate you taking the time to be on the podcast with you.
Once again, thank you so much for listening to the Publicly Challenged podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to. Also, if you could leave a review, that would help us out. And you could check us out on Instagram or at publiclychallenged.com. And once again, thank you so much for listening to the show.